Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress.
And I'm Mary Fiorito.
And we're here to talk about a new movie that's been getting a ton of publicity the last few weeks on the life of St. Maximilian Kolbe. And we're very excited to welcome Anthony D'Ambrosio to the show, the director and producer of the film Triumph of the Heart, coming to the theaters September 12th. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thank you so much, Betsy.
Well, our timing for the show, at least, is great because we've just celebrated the feast of St. Maximilian Kolbe last month. His sacrifice and courage in Auschwitz has gripped the hearts of countless Catholics across the globe. But Anthony, you have a very unique story in your own introduction to Kolbe that started when you were suffering from insomnia. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the story really starts. I was a seminarian. I left seminary with this great passion for evangelization for the church, and was madly in love, and was about to get married when I contracted an illness that nobody really knew how to diagnose. It later turned out to be a chronic like fungal infection, basically like the fungal version of Lyme's disease. But it took 10 years to diagnose that. And in the sort of meantime, my life basically just like absolutely imploded because as anybody knows who has suffered from like sleep deprivation, you can only do that for so long before basically you lose the ability to fully function. And that was certainly my story. I was sleeping about like 20 minutes to 2 hours a night. And waking up in the middle of the night, you know, with like the most devastatingly terrifying like panic attacks for no apparent reason. And I think that and kind of the fallout of that, I lost the job and the career that I was seeking, the relationship with the woman that I was about to get married to. I knew that we couldn't like move forward into marriage in sort of that state. And so my life was really like emptied, and I was totally heartbroken and devastated, and I just couldn't see how a good God could allow that to happen. And of course, I'd heard all of the intellectual arguments for God's existence. I had grown up steeped in the faith, but when I really encountered suffering like this that felt so sort of devastating and so meaningless, it really brought me to question. It questioned everything ultimately. And I left the church, I left my faith, and was really kind of leaving God behind. And it wasn't until I started to really, like, I was doing a writing job and I found the story of St. Maximilian Kolbe simply because a client was asking me to do a little biography of him. The research that I was doing really shocked me with some details about Kolbe's life that showed me in some ways that he was a kindred spirit, and that he had something to offer me that I had passed over. And specifically, it was the detail that he not only survived for 14 days in that starvation bunker, but there were nine other men with him, and that three of them survived all the way to the point of execution with him, that three men journeyed with him, sang songs with him, prayed with him, and sort of staged this rebellion of hope with him inside of that cell, singing songs so that the others outside of the cell who were walking by could remember their identities and remember that God loved them. And that story, it made me simultaneously angry and also showed me that there was something there that I needed to learn, that I needed to kind of reflect on. And So for the next years, began to just find myself meditating on this story in the middle of the night when I was waking up. I found it to be incredibly comforting and felt like in some ways Kolbe was like descending into my cell to help to teach me how to carry my cross and how to suffer well.
I didn't realize that until you just said it, Anthony, that there were others that survived along with him. My understanding was always that he was the last to die and, you know, accompanied the others to the end. But, you know, thinking back on what St. John Paul II said of him was that, you know, he was a saint for our troubled age. And when you think about how assisted suicide, or as it's now being called, medically assisted death, is gaining traction. I mean, you look at Canada and now in the United States. What do you think Kolbe's message of suffering has to say to our society today?
Yeah, I mean, it's just to go into sort of the perspective that I had at the time, like I when there's no meaning to life, there's no reason to suffer. Like if there is no God and there is no heaven, there is no meaning in suffering beyond perhaps like there's I think some sort of pagan type like heroism that you could like look at there, but ultimately speaking, the only alternative is either to end the suffering by distraction and medication or by ending the suffering by killing yourself if those things don't work. And that's really the immediate like next step logically from a world that does not have God. And I think that this story is really interesting because in Auschwitz, that was the initiation speech that was given to everybody that was brought in. You have 14 days to a month, depending on how much we hate you, to live. All of that life is going to be suffering. You should kill yourself now as soon as you can to get it over with. That was sort of the psychological game that demonically the Nazis were trying to play with these people. And so for Kolbe to step forward to give his life, to save the life of another man, and then to lead this sort of, I guess, rebellion of hope and prayer from inside of the starvation bunker, you see it in this like immediate contrast to the demonic voice of the culture of death that was, being given voice by the Nazis, but is still very prevalent in our world today.
I've been to Auschwitz. I've been to that cell. It's probably the most chilling day of my life. When did you go there for the first time? And tell us a little bit about recreating his life through film and what kind of production team you had and how all that fell together.
Absolutely. Yeah. The first time that I was there was 2022. I was still very ill. Frankly, this was, I felt like my body was really breaking down. I was kind of saying my goodbyes to people and writing. I was actively writing those letters while I was in Poland. But I had the fortune of staying with the friars in Oświęcim, which is the friary right outside of Auschwitz, and getting to really know how they remember him, like the oral tradition of their order. And I think that when I went to Auschwitz for the first time, yes, it was like really crushing, but it was also on his feast day where all of these Poles kind of come together, process in front of the cell and say a mass, and they sing traditional Polish hymns that likely would have been the songs that they were singing in the cell. And it was one of the most profound experiences of God's light kind of shining in testimony of resurrection over the darkness that I've ever like experienced. It was certainly like the most unique mass. Like I will never ever forget. Even to where I was standing on the doorstep of one of these, of one of the bunkers, one of the prison blocks, because it was like standing room only. So I was like just standing there, singing these Polish songs and celebrating kind of the life of a man who had suffered tremendously, but who obviously had inspired an entire country to have faith and have hope. And I just was like this story is so beautiful, like the conquering of the light over darkness in the story of Kolbe is a testimony to the fact that God can conquer the darkness in any person's life, no matter what. And if he can do that there, he can do that in my life. And so, yeah, I think I set out from that moment with this sort of mandate, like people need to tell the story, and I shouldn't be the one to do it because I'm an American, I'm not Polish, and I'm a first-time director. But God often chooses the people who are kind of the least expected to do the things that are sort of his biggest kind of plans, And I came back and immediately was given a diagnosis by a pro-life medical clinic in Denver, Colorado, that was able to find the infection and gave me they gave me a medication to help, and my life sort of came back together. I could sleep, and I immediately started working on kind of returning that gift by making the film. So we raised the money and went to Poland, and that's that. But I can tell more about the specific like experiences of working on it and the filmmaking process. But it really was like being on retreat with Americans and Poles, kind of collaborating to bring forward a story of one of the greatest heroes of the 20th century.
Well, Anthony, you were recently featured on EWTN's Pro Life Weekly show, and you were quite eloquent rather, when you said
I'll take elegant. I'll take
yes, elegant
elegant.
and eloquent. And for listeners who can't see him, he's a very, very dapper young man here. So for everyone who's suffering, there's this privilege that they have because the veil between heaven and earth is so thin. They can either be looking at and face to face with hell, or they can be looking at and face to face with heaven. Ultimately, I would ask them to knock on that door and to seek a vision of heaven cheering them on in the midst of their suffering. That is just, that's like incredibly profound. And did you finally then feel like you've talked about the hellish sort of piece of what you were suffering? What was it like the moment when you knocked on heaven's door instead?
In my research on Colby's story, one of the things that came forward that was like an interesting detail that really captivated me was that when he was in Japan, he was also chronically ill. He had chronic tuberculosis that really debilitated him. And of course, with somebody with as much energy and enthusiasm and as big of dreams and mission as him, it was so difficult for him to be bedridden for months, trying to kind of deal with his illness. And so during one of those months, he was on death's door, sick in Poland, or sorry, in Japan. And he had a dream about heaven that seems to have really rocked him, really changed him. After he kind of came back from that dream, he was very different in the way that he presented himself and spoke to the other people around him, even in his letters. When you read his letters to like his brothers and his family members, he begins to use sort of like pet names and the more like he goes from this more formal tone to this very tender, very like personal tone. And you can see this shift in his personality kind of happening. But he never shared what was in the dream. He never shared the specific contents of the dream, just that it was about heaven. And so I sort of, as an artist, began to like imagine what that might have been like, and my kind of answer to that is like I think Christ gives us the best image of heaven in the banquet of like the wedding banquet of the Lamb. Like that is what Scripture gives us as what heaven is going to be like. So I just imagined it to be a dream about a Polish wedding, and I don't want to give any spoiler alerts, but we filmed a Polish wedding in the movie, and it was one of the first things that we shot, because we had to do everything in reverse, right? Where we're going to shave all the guys' heads so that we shoot them in Poland, but in heaven they should have their hair, so we're going to shoot that, you know, before we do the shaving. We all get together. The first thing that we shoot is this heaven scene, and it was like, when we got in there, it felt like we were touching Saint Maximilian Kolbe. Like every time that we touched him, you know, we're all dancing. So like arm in arm, there's moments where we even like kind of got him up on our arms and we're throwing him up and down. You know, it's just like this great celebration. But every touch felt like we were face to face with the actual man of Kolbe. It was an uncanny spiritual experience. And when we finished, we went outside, and those people who were, we had this big monitor, and you'd have like all of your set, all the different people who are like working on it are like watching the monitor for anything that's out of place, anything that they need to notice or fix. We walk out, and everybody is just like in tears, you know, like holding each other, because it was like, when you see it, like when you see it in the movie, if you do not cry watching it, it's like, you have a stony heart, like because it's such a beautiful representation of like of God's victory and his love. And so when we all saw that, I think all of us just knew like heaven is with us, is watching us as we make this film, as we tell the story. We're treading on sacred ground, and there's like a power that God is sort of like bottling up in every image that we're producing, that that when we unleash and we give it to people to watch, it's going to really like move hearts. So yeah.
We're talking with filmmaker Antonio D'Ambrosio about his new movie on Saint Maximilian Kolbe, Triumph of the Heart. And I'm telling you, if you watch the trailer, and you can watch it at triumphoftheheart.com, you are going to want to see this movie. It's harrowing and compelling. And I wanted to ask you a question, Anthony, about the family who's the man who's Maximilian Kolbe took his place so that he could live, because he broke down and, screaming. And this is in the trailer. I have a wife, I have children. What is the current day situation of that family? Are people in contact with them?
Yeah, so Francis Guy Nietzsche was the is the man that Kolbe saved, and I always hate it when people ask me this question, because it's like one of the darker like things about this story, which is that unbeknownst to him, his family had already been killed in World War II, that he in fact no longer had a wife and children in that moment when he
I
was
did not
screaming
know
out.
that. Wow.
And so when he went back and kind of discovered this, he dedicated his life to sharing about the story of Saint Maximilian Kolbe. And he was actually there, and he was present during the canonization process. But his life, I think, is for him to be prepared to face that reality. Like, I think what Maximilian Kolbe did that I think a lot of people don't realize is that, like, the temptation of the time was despair. Like, death was not the worst thing that could happen to a person at the time. It was to completely lose their souls. And the Germans were trying, directly, intentionally trying to make that happen. And so the evil that they were perpetrating on people like Francis Guy Nietzsche was meant to demoralize and destroy his identity. So, like, not only did Kolbe save his life, but by showing him love and showing him how to face suffering, like, his soul was also redeemed. And that's like the most, I think, beautiful part of the story of what Kolbe was able to do, not just for him, but for the all of the people in Auschwitz at the time that were witnesses to what he did.
What one of the aspects of the that moment when Kolbe walks forward and says, "Take me instead," was that that commandant apparently had an incredible reputation for cruelty, so much so that another inmate who had been kind of standing nearby thought, "Oh my gosh, he's just going to take them both," because that's the kind of cruel person. But that some kind of change came over his face in that moment, and he granted Kolbe's request and left the other man standing. Does your movie go into that particular moment at all, or what might have happened spiritually at that very second?
Yeah, I think that the greatest tragedies, you see this in, like, for instance, in Hamlet, where the best tragedies give the antagonist a moment where you can tell that they're being seduced by the good, where they're just an inch away from making the decision that would change their life and that would bring the whole kind of story to a comedic, and by comedic, I don't mean funny, but in the traditional sense, like the sort of like a whole, like it makes the story whole. And I think that that was that a moment like that for Fritsch, where he was being kind of presented with this like fork in the road, and quite shockingly was overcome by kind of the heroism of Kolbe's stance. And I think that a big part of that is that, like, his whole perspective was built on power, and on discipline. And Kolbe's stepping out of line was like an act. And people sort of describe it as if it was like kind of halfway between somebody being humble and being a general. That Colby had this kind of strange combination of those two things in him, of kind of being subservient to the commandant and also being another commander advocating for one of his soldiers. And I think that this garnered respect. But I also think that there was this temptation. This is conjecture, so this isn't something that was like written down or anything, but as I kind of like tried to understand the character of Fritsch, I think that he saw an opportunity to, knowing Colby is this commander, right? That if he enters into this sort of game with the commander and is able to demoralize him and destroy his soul instead, that he will have like a more complete and greater victory. And so on one hand, he's sort of like fascinated by Colby's power and discipline and like his love, shocked by it. And then on the other hand is seeing an opportunity to play a political game. And so that was how I portrayed it in the film.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a really enlightening conversation about a beautiful saint for our times. To learn more about Triumph of the Heart and Anthony D'Ambrosio, make sure to check out triumphoftheheart.com.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. We are joined by our wonderful TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, who is going to tell us today a little bit about these two wonderful saints who are being canonized this upcoming weekend. Welcome to the show, Monsignor.
It's great to be back with you, Ashley. Hope you had a wonderful vacation.
I did. I'm feeling very rested and very ready to dive right into this exciting moment in the church where we have the first millennial saint. So tell us, you know so much about both of these young men. Tell us about them and what to expect in their canonization and what connections they share.
So this weekend, this Sunday, we have big news, not just for young Catholics across the globe, but for all Catholics across the globe, because Pope Leo is going to be canonizing two real heroes of faith for people of every generation. The first is now Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, who died at the age of 24, 100 years ago, this July 4th. He died July 4th, 1925. And he came from a very well-known family in Turin. His dad was the head of La Stampa, a newspaper that still exists. His dad was a senator, all of it. But very quietly, Pier Giorgio Frassati had this extraordinary mission to the poor as a member of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. He was a Third Order Dominican and really loved Dominican spirituality. He was a great adorer of the Blessed Sacrament, and he used to bring so many of his friends to adore the Lord there too. And when John Paul II beatified him in 1990, he called him the man of the Beatitudes, somebody who shows us the real joy of Christian life lived by one's conformity to Jesus. And so he's had a great influence over the course of the last century on young adult Catholics. I like to say, especially young adult women Catholics, because many young adult women find Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati about the most handsome saint of all time. And so I presume that there's going to be a lot of enthusiastic young women in St. Peter's Square on Sunday. But one young boy who had a great devotion to Pier Giorgio as he was growing up is the other being canonized, Saint Carlo Acutis, who died in 2006, only at the age of 15. Carlo Acutis, like almost all boys growing up in Italy, would have had some exposure to Pier Giorgio Frassati. And he imitated him in several ways. He imitated his love for Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. He imitated Pier Giorgio's extraordinary capacity for friendship. He imitated Pier Giorgio's great and abundant charity by the way he cared for others. Carlo Acutis has outpaced Pier Giorgio Frassati as of late. His cult has become one of the largest in the church. Personally, I believe that Carlo Acutis is going to be to the 21st century what Thérèse Lisieux was to the 20th century. After the Blessed Mother, after Saint Joseph, the most famous saint of the century, because he shows not just the young, but everybody how to live our faith in this technological age with great focus on the Lord Jesus. Carlo Acutis is the one who, out of his love for the Lord Jesus, built the Miracles of the World site, the Eucharistic posters of 196 great Eucharistic miracles that have crisscrossed the world to all five continents to help us learn what he himself taught in his tender years, that a Eucharistic life is the true highway to heaven. And so, how lucky we are to be alive at the time of their canonization. And I would be urging everybody to be tuning on in to EWTN early on Sunday morning to watch those beatifications live, or if they have to sleep the fete morning, as the French say on Sunday, to at least watch it on demand later. Because I think that this is going to be not only a great celebration for the whole church, but Pope Leo is going to sound some notes for all the love, for all the young people all across the globe about how not just to celebrate their canonization, but to imitate their Christian life.
Well, I encourage all our listeners, as Monsignor said, if you can't get up and watch it in the morning, you can always replay EWTN's coverage live. That's certainly what my family did during those weeks of the conclave and the funeral of our past pope. But what an exciting time to be Catholic, especially for young people, but for all people, as you say. Thank you, Monsignor, for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Ashley, and I just urge everybody to pray for the young people in their families and in their parishes through the intercession of these two saints to be. God bless.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are thrilled to have today the one and only Marie Miller. She is a singer and songwriter known across the country and the globe. She has performed beautifully at so many events, including Seek. She performed for Pope Francis when he was in Philadelphia in 2015. And she has just released a new song on the soon-to-be Saints Carlos Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati, who will be canonized by Pope Leo XIV this coming weekend. Marie, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So you have an interesting journey from pop music to writing songs as a Catholic musician. You were at one point opening up for, of all things, the Backstreet Boys, and you were really in very much a secular sphere and a secular atmosphere. And sometimes you topped the contemporary and Christian Billboard charts, I think, at the same time, if I'm correct on that.
So, yes, I had music on Christian radio that my song You're Not Alone actually was number one just for 1 week, but still.
Right. Still counts.
And then,
still counts.
Yeah. And then I was also being played on a bunch of pop stations. I don't think I ever charted on those, but SiriusXM had me on heavy rotation, which was really exciting. So I was being heard by both audiences at the same time, which was awesome.
Well, you're quoted in the Catholic Herald as saying at that time in 2023, I never wanted to say I was a Catholic artist necessarily, really because I didn't feel like I had it right. I'm just a broken person. I'm a sinner. How can I proclaim the gospel? Can you tell us a little bit more about that? That's a beautiful statement, by the way. It's very, you know, it's filled with humility and self-knowledge, but I think others probably would give you a little bit of pushback on that for saying that you didn't belong yet in the Catholic sphere.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, yes, that's a very honest statement. And for me, what really changed my outlook on that was I started reading about Saint Therese and her way of love, her way of merciful love.
Right.
And I didn't know really about God's mercy till I started learning about her. And her whole thing is about God's mercy. And what she taught me was that God's mercy is not about how good you are, but how good he is. And so his mercy is for all of us. And so what I do with my music is I am always trying to point people towards people that are a lot smarter, a lot holier than me. And so, yeah, as long as I don't go, hey guys, look how great I'm doing. I've got everything together. You need to be just like me. But rather, here is a place where I go to be healed and where I go to become closer to our Lord Jesus. I talk about the Eucharist in my songs. I talk about Saint Therese. I talk about Our Lady. And these are the weapons we need to fight sin and evil. So that's what I'm doing now. But it took me a while to figure that out.
So Marie, let's go back to the beginning a little bit. You're from a very large family, I believe 10 children.
Mm-hmm.
And was music a big part of your childhood? And you have other siblings who play instruments.
Yes, music was a huge part of my childhood. And I do have several siblings that are incredibly talented, but they aren't professional musicians. And so they will play with me every once in a while, but unfortunately, I'm the only one. My dad wanted to start a family band, and I'm the only member left.
So you play the guitar, you play the mandolin beautifully. I have really enjoyed listening to your work online. And are there any other instruments you play?
Yes, I also play piano and an instrument called the bouzouki, which is really just a mandolin an octave lower. And thank you very much. Yeah, I love my mandolin. It's so easy to travel with, too. It's just a little tiny thing.
I noticed that on the videos. And I thought a little bit about Nickel Creek when I was listening to you and how they were a family band. And who were some of your musical inspirations as you grew up playing music?
Yes. So Nickel Creek was a huge inspiration. There was this movement called the Newgrass Movement, mm-hmm. and Alison Krauss and all these wonderful musicians. Yeah. Brought back acoustic music. And I fell in love with that, especially when we moved from California to Virginia and we started learning about bluegrass, Newgrass, Irish folk music. And yes, so I actually, before Nickel Creek was really popular, their mandolin player's name is Chris Thiele. And I went to a mandolin camp and he was my teacher. And he,
really?
Yeah,
oh, my kids loved him growing up. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't remember this, but I will always remember that he named an exercise after me, a pinky exercise. So that's my claim to fame.
Well, like so many people, you were profoundly influenced, Marie, by The Chosen. Can you tell us a little bit about how and why that series impacted you? And are you still a follower of the show today? And does it continue to inspire you?
Yes, The Chosen was so important. It was part of that same time that I was reading about Saint Therese. And I was learning, because The Chosen shows you very clearly that the disciples are broken and that Jesus is working with them where they are. My favorite scene in The Chosen is in the first season it's definitely first or second. And it's when Mary Magdalene and Jesus, she kind of goes back to her old ways. And she says to Jesus, I can't do this. And he says, what, you know, and she says this, and he says, I just need your heart. The rest will come. And so it really inspired me. One of the most beautiful things about it too, is that when Jesus and her having that conversation, Our Lady is standing next to her. And that subtle, just awesome idea that in conversation, when we come back from our sin, is that Our Lady is sort of with us too. So yes, I do love The Chosen. I need to catch up on it.
But it's interesting how it's had such an impact on both Catholics and Protestants in a very similar way. And I love how you mention Our Lady just sort of standing to the side, because I think some of their Protestant writers and producers don't quite know what to do with Mary. And I think it's about a half-half Catholic Protestant production. And but I thought that was a very subtle way as well to acknowledge her and the way that we see her as an advocate and an intercessor. And not imposing her will on others, but rather, you know, praying along with us for the things that she hopes will bring us closer to her son. So, yeah, it's been a profoundly impactful movie. But again, I think what's drawn so many people like you is the very brokenness of those characters.
Yeah, no, totally. And what a gift it is. I do think that there's a renaissance of Christian art, especially in film. And I'm just seeing some really beautiful, beautiful stuff coming out. There's a movie about Maximin Kolbe that's coming out, and just so beautiful that we're seeing. And these are young artists. I just did the Napa Institute had its first art festival, which had brought a bunch of artists, and artists doing really big things in the church and outside of the church. And so I'm excited. And The Chosen, I think, kind of spearheaded that. And so it's a great gift. And I really hope that this grows, because it's an exciting time for artists right now.
So Marie, as Mary mentioned in the introduction, you were an intro lead-in to the Backstreet Boys. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you got from playing music with your dad up to then, and then we'll go from there to how you became a uniquely Catholic artist at this point.
Yes. So grew up playing bluegrass music. I got signed to Curb Records when I was 15. They're a country label, but they also had a Christian side. So I actually started out doing Christian music. But then what happened was that I got on Sirius XM on their pop station. And so then the record label just ran with that and said, okay, we're going to do this. And so I thought, okay, cool. I mean, my songs are mainly about relationships and friendships and growing up. And I wasn't really writing as much Christian music at that time. And so it worked out. And then, yeah, so they put me on the road all the time. I was at tons of radio stations performing my music, promoting it. And yes, got to open for the Backstreet Boys and also Five for Fighting and the Wallflowers, and went on tours and everything. And I loved it so much. I've always, always loved being on stage performing. It's so, it feels more like home than anything else. And so for me, it was amazing. But as I got older, and as I was thinking about these lyrics I'm writing about, particularly romance and heartbreak, and I was asking the question, so if all these relationships worked out, if all these aches in my heart were gone, would I be fully satisfied? And as I grew in my faith, I knew the answer was no, and that my heart was shaped for an infinite heart, for love so much bigger than any person could ever give me. And it was the love of Jesus. And so I started writing more in that vein. And then I was too scared because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm watching all these Catholic speakers at all these conferences and things, and they look so perfect, and I'm not really, I don't know if I belong and all that kind of stuff. But I've been around the Catholic world my whole life. My dad is a vice president at Focus. I mean, I've just been around this world. And so it was kind of easy in some ways, but very intimidating too. But when, again, St. Therese was with me, and really my goal is just to bring people closer to the Lord through my music. So John Paul II says, beauty is a call to transcendence. It stirs in us the hidden nostalgia for God. And man, beauty has done that for me in my life so much. Seeing a sunset or hearing a beautiful piece of music or watching a beautiful film. I mean, it just stirs in us. So I wanted to do that too.
Well, I'm
your
glad
relative,
you...
Go ahead, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to follow up, because I read that his letter to artists was very important for you. And I just wanted you to tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yes. Yeah, so I read his letter when I was really young, and it was a big part of how I started connecting beauty with my faith. So when I was younger, it was, okay, we have to go to church and we have to pray. My family is super Catholic, and I get to do really fun stuff like play music. So I'm thinking, okay, you got to go to church, but you get to sing and you get to play music. But John Paul II was the first person that showed me that the beauty that I was so attracted to was pointing towards beauty himself. And so this longing in my heart was for the transcendent, for him and his beauty. And so then it started connecting, and that was really, really special for me.
Well, Marie, you're relatively recently married within the last few years. And speaking of things that are transcendent, you know, it's been said that marriage is one of the ways that we can better understand God's love for us, is, you know, that exclusive and faithful love. How has being married affected the way that you write your lyrics or that you think about what you sing?
Yes. And so when I decided to go to just do religious music, marriage had a big part of it, and also just the potential for motherhood, was that I don't want to bring my kids to a folk festival at an 11 p.m. concert. And in that environment, even in the best places, there's still a lot of secular influence. And I wanted to bring them, and I want to bring them to places that are beautiful, that have the mass and adoration. And so that really was a big part of it. So far, the Lord has not given us earthly children yet, but it's still in my mind. It's like, okay, I want to be as holy as possible for my future children. And yeah, and also just for my husband too, because marriage is really hard. No one told me that.
Really?
They don't go over that at pre-Cana in much depth. Yeah.
So I think probably the closer you are to Christ, the easier it is. And so that's definitely a factor as well.
Well, it's interesting because on your website, I listened to a beautiful rendition of Tantum Ergo. So let's talk a little bit about contemporary worship music and how there's some people who are hardcore that they want really old hymns, tried and true, which I love. There's some people that say, oh, to reach young people, you need to have contemporary music. Where do you fall on how you, when you listen to what kinds of music and what you think about certain kinds of music in church and in mass?
That's a great question. Being someone that loves folk music, which is a music that promotes tradition, this idea that we're having music that was sang, you know, hundreds of years ago, and now we're singing it today. Now we're playing it today. I tend to love more of the hymns. Now I love Irish hymns, songs that like "Be Thou My Vision" is from an Irish tune. I love any of that. The King of Love, My Shepherd Is. Those are some of my favorites. And so personally, my personal taste is hymns with a little bit of a contemporary bent to it. That's what, moves me the most. But of course, it's so subjective. A lot of my friends do worship music and they love that. I tend to love, yeah, a contemporary style hymn the most, but I think it all works. And I wrote a song with Sarah Hart, who is in all the hymnals. We wrote a song called Woman. And so every time I'm singing this new contemporary song, if I go to a more contemporary church, I go, well, who wrote that? Oh, it's Sarah Hart. So I'm writing with people that do contemporary stuff, but and for me, it's more, a little more traditional.
So at the time we're taping this, Marie, we're coming up, we're several days away now from the canonizations of two young men, Carlos Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati. Talk to us a little bit about how, you know, two young Italian men who, you know, didn't spend a whole lot of time, like Joseph Lasio, didn't spend a whole lot of time on this side of the veil, but they seem to have had a really profound impact on you. Can you describe how you came to know them first, and then what particularly about their lives impacted you the most?
Yes. So Carlo Acutis came into my life when I was going through a really hard time, and I was looking for a novena to do, and I just went in which saint would be 9 days after I do this or 10 days. I can't remember what I chose. And it was Carlo Acutis. I'd never heard of him. And I grew up with awesome brothers, and I have a lot of really great guy friends. I was a tomboy growing up. And so when I read about him, I was thinking, this could be my brother. He could be my brother. He could be my friend. So I started talking to him in a way that maybe I wouldn't talk to another saint. And so we became friends very quickly. And what I love most about him is his love for the Eucharist and how he would go to adoration before school, because adoration has been what's changed my life so much, and what makes me love the Mass so much too. So I actually struggle sometimes paying attention in Mass, but when I spend time in adoration and I realize who I'm about to receive, it's much easier. So I love him for that. I just thought he was really cool. People really focus on the computer side of Carlo, but I think that there's a lot more to him too. I mean, he seemed like just a really cool kid who was just friendly and kind. And I loved the picture of him in the Spider-Man Halloween costume. assume. So I love that. And also, you guys are amazing. I loved listening to fun facts about Carlo that you guys posted. That was awesome. So yeah, I don't know as much about Pier Giorgio Frassati, but this, in the same way that they talk about heaven is our homeland, right, to the heights, this idea that we are climbing a mountain towards God. And so that's why my song is called Highest Home, because I think they both had very clear vision that we are not made for this earth.
You wrote a beautiful op-ed about that song in which you wrote, our culture is obsessed with superheroes and stories about young people saving the day. But what's more heroic than choosing to be a saint? What's more radical than giving your whole life to Christ? Do you ever have young people write to you or come up to you or say, this really speaks to me, as you know, we're going into this, as Mary said, big weekend with these two saints. How does all of that impact you in the feedback that you get from people about writing songs like that?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. It's the best compliment I was ever given was that a girl heard me sing and she said, I just want to go pray. I just want to go pray now. And oh, that is just, as a Catholic artist, that is the greatest gift you can ever hear, because you don't want people to just go back and go, oh, that was cool, thanks for singing. But really that it leads them to beauty himself. And so this song, I hope, will help young people really think about, like, I don't have to wait. When I was young, I loved to dwell on the existential crisis of being young. And I was like, it's life is so hard. No one understands me. I really kind of leaned into mediocrity. And these young men, they were able to go, nope, I want to be a saint now. And so that's what I really hope that they see. But yeah, it's amazing for me. Before, when I would sing about heartbreaker or like friendships that didn't work out, and people would say, oh, I really relate to that. That's good. You know, we all can have those moments, but wow, it's a lot cooler when someone says, I want to pray afterwards. It just makes me so happy.
Mm. Well, do you find that you're resonating with young adult and teenage Catholic women? You know, I feel like so many of them, I have three young adult girl daughters, or obviously girl daughters, they're girls. And they're really finding it difficult, you know, to sort of connect in a world that I guess now more than ever is just simply so focused on not just materialism, but also physical looks, all of those things. And that, of course, you know, God appreciates beauty and wants them to, you know, as you said, lean in, you know, to the gifts that God's given them. But how do you find, you know, the messages that you're trying to impart to young women these days? What do you find that their struggles are specifically? And how do you feel that the particular message of your music can reach them?
Yeah, I think they struggle with the same thing that I struggle with, which is, so Saint Therese compared herself to the woman at the well, which is crazy. How different could these two women be? But she said, I wish to quench the thirst like the woman at Samaria. And I think sometimes we think that God's thirst for our love is measured by our brokenness. And we don't think about he truly thirsts for us no matter where we are. And also, does he thirst for us? Because we hear a lot of stories about big conversions and then super holy saints. But what about us in the middle, right? The non-splashy sins, the everyday brokenness. Does Jesus thirst for us too? And so I really struggle with truly believing that. With truly believing that he wants me right where I am. Mother Teresa has this amazing letter that she writes to her sisters. And she says, you don't have to be different to be loved. And that is really what I struggle with. And so when I sing my song, Woman, I talk about that because I can't teach. I can just tell you how I feel about things. But I have found that's been helpful, that just knowing that Jesus thirsts for you right where you are.
One of your early songs that was quite a hit, you said was written for a friend of yours. Can you tell us about that song and how your songwriting has progressed? Are you still looking for themes from friends? Or are you more focused on the saints now?
Yes, I wrote that song for a friend that was going through a really hard time, and his parents were going through a divorce, and I didn't know what to say to him. And my sister and I decided to give up sweets for a year. That sounds really impressive, but
a year.
Like,
wow.
Yeah. We're not really sweets people, though. So, I mean, it was like good, but it wasn't. It'd be way harder if you were a chocolate lover or something. We were not that. It was just a little thing for us, but we wanted to do just something. And, but we just thought that would be just a nice thing. And just to go, okay, we're going to do what we can and we're going to be with him through it. We're going to walk through this really difficult time. So the idea, you're not alone. I'm going to stand with you no matter what's going on. And I would say that I am writing mostly about religious themes at the moment, but I kind of just let my writing lead me where I'm feeling. So I'm not opposed to writing about other things. And when I perform, I still perform those old songs. I wrote a song called 6'2" about praying for your future husband. And
you're going to ask about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So
was that a song or a prayer?
That was a prayer song, right? Yeah. No, I wrote it as a joke and it was funny. I wrote it as a joke. And then the record label said, oh, we love this one. And that one was actually on Dancing with the Stars, believe it or not. They waltzed to it, which is so special. So a prayer was on Dancing with the Stars.
Wow. Well, who do you think among the secular artists that everybody knows are kind of giving stealth spiritual messages? I think of Dolly Parton sometimes when I think of this, because a lot of her music is deeply spiritual. And even artists like Tom Petty or Bruce Springsteen have particular songs where they do have some kind of faith. It might not be the way we express it. Is there anybody else you particularly like in modern music now that that you find also brings a spiritual message to people?
Yeah, I would say that Carrie Underwood did a gospel album, which I thought was really great. And I think some of the country artists are leaning in to their faith quite a bit. Randy Travis, who can't sing anymore. It's really sad. He lost his voice, but he was an artist. Yeah. Back in the day, his gospel albums were so great. And even just Three Wooden Crosses is a song that he wrote. So I love when there's a kind of a breakthrough in it. Again, my knowledge is much more country and folk, so that's what I know. But I love, I love Andre Bocelli and all the stuff that he does. So it's so cool to see that. But also, wouldn't you say too, is that I think actors are really kind of coming out as Christians right now, which has been really cool. I don't remember that growing up. I feel like it's kind of a new thing.
Who are you thinking of specifically?
Chris Pratt and Mark Wahlberg. I sang at a mass, and Patricia Heaton from Everybody Loves Raymond was there. You know,
oh, she's had a huge reversion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very outspoken.
Yeah. So it's really cool because it just gives you, as artists especially, this feeling that, you know, you don't have to be shy. You just be yourself and don't be afraid to talk about Jesus. Mm.
Marie, we just have a little bit of time left. Tell us what's in store and where you'll be performing within the next 6 months and how all our listeners can find out more about you and listen to your work.
Yes. So my website is mariemillermusic.com and my Instagram is mariemillersing. On the website, there is the calendar so you can see where I am going to be. Just kind of all over the place right now. My most special event will be in Lafayette, Louisiana, in front of St. Therese's Relics. I'll be able to give my musical presentation on her, on the Way of Love. So I interweave my songs and stories and her teachings. And so I can't believe she's going to be in the U.S. Her relics will be here. So I'll get to do that. And then that's exciting. I'll also be singing with the Notre Dame Choir next week, and I'll be recording with them. And I always wanted to go to Notre Dame. So this is my way of getting in. My brother and my husband went. So now I'm excited. I'll at least get to say I did something at Notre Dame.
Right. Well, it's a beautiful campus this time of year as well. And I didn't realize that Therese's relics were back in the U.S. I think it's been like 25 years. So how exciting to be present for that. So, well, listeners, again, if you'd like to follow Marie Miller or learn a little bit more about her music, mariemillermusic.com. And to learn more about us at the Catholic Association, follow us at thecatholicassociation.org, and you'll find everything that we do in radio, TV, print, online, and in our local communities. This has been Mary Fiorito and Betsy Fentress with Marie Miller. Thank you for joining us today.